something stupid. She'll be consumed by embarrassment, even shame, and have a hard time letting it go. She might decide to avoid this by keeping her mouth shut in the future. And then she'll be criticized for being too cautious or not contributing. The fear of making mistakes is, of course, compounded by the fact that, as a woman, your mistakes are often viewed more critically in male organizational cultures. Your errors may be seized on as proof that women in general can't make the grade, which can affect how other women in the company are viewed. This compounds the guilt you feel over having made a mistake and over not being perfect. This process is intensified if you're a member of a minority. In the United States, African-American women often feel the burden of carrying the expectations of their entire community on their shoulders, as do immigrants from many cultures in Europe, North America, and Asia. Women from India, at home and abroad, may feel pressure not just to be the perfect employee and high performer, but the perfect daughter-in-law, constantly trying to appease a family that is skeptical of her every move. If you're in one of these situations, learning to let go of the desire to be perfect assumes a special urgency, lest you sink under the weight of expectations. In order to rise, you have to lay your burden down. The cost. Carlos Marin notes that people who set very high standards for themselves usually set very high standards for others. This can make coworkers and direct reports feel resentful. So while it's understandable that a woman might believe that being perfect is her only path to success, her strenuous efforts will often come back to bite her. Take the case of Vera, a super high performer at a global insurance company headquartered in Northern Europe. Vera is an intellectual powerhouse, extraordinarily hardworking and superbly organized. She speaks 5 languages, is an outstanding public speaker, and has scored major successes in both operations and finance. All of this made her a natural candidate for CEO of her company, but her perfectionism ended up undermining her when she was scouted for the job. Her vulnerability surfaced when the company began soliciting feedback on its top 3 candidates. It turned out that people she worked with, while they respected her work ethic and were generally in awe of her achievements, often found her over-controlling and judgmental. One close colleague wrote, "Vera is an amazing performer and unsparing in her dedication, but she tends to ask too much of people. She's so worried about failure that she ends up micromanaging her team and driving us to exhaustion." Another reported, "It's impossible to be relaxed around Vera because she's always nervous that something will go wrong. As a result, her meetings feel totally scripted. Nobody wants to throw out some bright ideas that haven't already been fully vetted because she'll find 5 ways it could end up in a disaster. That limits creativity in her division. People meet their performance objectives, but you don't see a lot of innovation, even though people in her unit are exceptionally smart." In addition to alienating coworkers, Vera's perfectionism has made her reluctant to take risks. Sweating the small stuff usually has this effect. If you're trying to be perfect, every task or encounter feels high stakes. You're always on the lookout for something to go wrong, since even the smallest glitch has the power to undermine your perfect image. Risk-taking requires being open to failure. While risk must be thoughtfully assessed, the outcome is never assured or entirely within your control. The desire to be perfect, by contrast, keeps you focused on what you can control. This narrows your horizons and demonstrates insecurity instead of the confidence in the future that being an effective leader requires. In the end, risk aversion was the chief reason Vera was bypassed for the CEO position. She had remarkable talents, but at the highest executive level, where big decisions about the future need to be made, some degree of risk-taking is essential if the organization is to evolve and grow. A board member involved in the search summed it up. "Vera is brilliant at dealing with situations where potential difficulties can be seen and known. But what worked in the past doesn't help you build the future. For that, you need a healthy ability to trust, willingness to take considered risks, and a big vision of what the organization could become. The healthy perfectionist. Of course, the drive to deliver superb results can be an enormous asset, so long as your perfectionistic tendencies can be curbed. As an example, Coach Julie Johnson points to one of her clients, Dana, who she describes as a healthy perfectionist. Dana has spent the last 18 years on the executive committee of an international transport company and is considered the coolest head in the room by her CEO. Julie describes what makes Dana different from other perfectionists. She says, Dana has very high standards, but she's learned not to be controlling. She knows that people are human and make mistakes. She doesn't focus on one little thing that went wrong and judge the whole based on that. She notices the detail, but considers it in a larger context. She's a perfectionist by nature, a detailed person for sure, but she has a broad perspective and is very tolerant with people. She works incredibly hard, but is often the first to let go when things don't turn out as planned. And she has a great sense of humor, so she can handle criticism and put people at ease. It all comes down to her being a confident person. Julie notes that Dana has two skills most perfectionists lack. She's good at delegating, and she knows how to prioritize. Perfectionists usually struggle with delegation. If you have super exacting standards, it stands to reason you'd have difficulty letting others do their jobs. And because monitoring people's efforts is time-consuming and often fraught, you just may decide that it's easier and quicker to do the job yourself. The upshot is that you end up loading extra tasks onto your already-too-full plate. You involve yourself in phone calls you have no need to be on, or proof preliminary drafts of reports that someone else is in charge of. If you make such interventions a habit, your team will get used to having every step of their performance checked, so they'll become less diligent about preparation. After all, why should they put in a lot of effort when you're going to end up inserting yourself at every stage of the process? By rushing in, you take away their incentive to perform, to learn, to grow, and to get better. This is how dysfunctional teams are born. And if you struggle with delegation at work, you may also find it difficult at home. You take up the slack for your kids when they neglect their chores or forget to tell you about after-school events that require special transportation. Like your coworkers, your kids come to expect your intervention and get accustomed to the idea they don't need to take responsibility. If this describes you, you might consider whether you're enabling those around you to be helpless, which is what people who fail to delegate often do. If this is your pattern at work and at home, you may end up expiring from stress or becoming trapped in a resentful martyrdom. Willingness to delegate becomes ever more important as you move to higher levels. You may have more people to manage, more of whom have specialized skills and knowledge. If you try to do their job for them, you'll be eaten alive. So if it's easier to do it myself is your go-to response, you might want to consider that you are undermining your potential as a leader, as well as taking on a lot of extra work. A root cause of the failure to delegate is often an inability to prioritize, to decide what's important and what doesn't require your attention. If you're trying to be perfect, you're going to struggle with prioritizing, because you're only comfortable when everything is right. So you may treat being 2 minutes late for a meeting as seriously as missing the filing date for a finance report, since both undermine your need to demonstrate perfection. If you have perfectionist tendencies, you can best serve your long-term interests by learning to delegate, prioritize, and get comfortable taking measured risks. This will create a less stressful environment for you and others and demonstrate your readiness to move forward. The good news is that you will be the primary beneficiary if you lay your burden down, but only if you can accept not being perfect.
Chapter 12, Habit 8, The Disease to Please. Trying to be a perfect person is a trap, given human limitations, but trying to be a wonderful person can be a trap as well. The desire to be wonderful in all circumstances, to be thoughtful and nice and make everyone around you feel good is known among coaches as the disease to please. It's considered particularly prevalent among women. If you're a chronic pleaser, chances are you know it. You may even talk about it, usually in an apologetic tone. And you're probably aware of how it holds you back. Maybe you routinely say yes to tasks and jobs you know will eat up your time, but bring you little benefit. Maybe you spend hours commiserating with people who seem to enjoy complaining and then wonder what you do to attract them. Maybe you get enmeshed with colleagues who have a knack for creating dramas and whom others seem to skillfully avoid. You resolve to keep away from them, but end up getting sucked into their toxic orbit. The disease to please can undermine your ability to make clear decisions because you're always trying to split the difference among competing needs in hopes of creating consensus or avoiding giving offense. This can impair your judgment and leave you vulnerable to manipulation by people who know how to use guilt to get others to accommodate their needs. It can rob you of the capacity to act with authority for fear of disappointing others or making them, even temporarily, unhappy. It can make you an unreliable advocate or ally because you're so easily swayed. It can distract you from your purpose, squander your time and talents, and contribute to your general stuckness. The disease to please is anything but pleasant, and it can be positively poisonous for your career. But what makes you this way, and how can you break the habit? Like perfectionists, chronic pleasers usually have difficulty delegating. Perfectionists resist it because they believe they can do everything better, while pleasers are motivated by the desire to be helpful and a reluctance to burden others or let down anyone who might have relied on them in the past. You may be aware of all these drawbacks, yet still find yourself hooked on pleasing because the effort you put into being helpful and putting others first makes you feel like a good person. Certainly, there are men who find themselves in these no-win situations, but psychologists and coaches will tell you that the disease to please is more typically found in women. Why? The answer is probably a combination of factors. As already noted, research shows that girls are more likely to be rewarded for being obedient, agreeable, helpful to others, and nice, both at home and at school. And organizations often shepherd entry and mid-level women into helping positions where they're judged on their ability to meet the needs of others and may be penalized for self-assertion. Also, as we saw in the previous chapter, even women at senior levels tend to be most highly rewarded when they fulfill expectations and act in ways that others find pleasing rather than when they act boldly or assert independent views. Pleasing also gives women the opportunity to use the nurturing and intuitive strengths that they have developed over millennia of evolution and upon which their families depend. These include sensitivity to human interaction and a gift for noticing when others are upset, worried, frightened, or tuned out. These are skills many women hone over a lifetime, skills that get a special workout if you become a mother. Obviously, these skills provide many advantages, not only at home, but also at work. The ability to read the needs of others gives you an edge when it comes to motivating, engaging, and communicating with customers, clients, peers, and direct reports. It can be of great benefit to your organization and your customers, especially as hearts and minds engagement becomes an ever more critical component of success. Yet, when the need to be liked or perceived as helpful overwhelms other considerations, the skills that should provide an advantage can prove detrimental. And while the need to please may serve you in the earlier stages of your career, it will impede you as you move higher, eroding your capacity to demonstrate leadership and serving as the ultimate tool for giving your power away. The linchpin. Nancy is a senior administrator at a highly rated regional medical center. She started her career as a receptionist with only 2 years of community college. No one in her family had gone beyond high school, and she had never envisioned herself in management. But she's smart, efficient, very hardworking, and remarkably warm and cheerful. Soon after she started, medical teams began relying on her to coordinate with patients. Patients loved her, and the center soon began receiving notes about how much Nancy had helped them. Community ratings for the center began to rise. Then a local philanthropist made a stunningly large donation because his mother had been so well treated by Nancy. After 2 years, senior staff decided she was wasting her time with reception duties. They created a patient advocate position for her and pointed her to a free tuition program where she earned a 4-year degree in hospital administration. Nancy rose steadily through the ranks. She was asked to start an outreach initiative for families of patients with serious chronic disease to involve them in proactively managing care. She created a highly visible community engagement program that raised the center's regional profile. She helped develop patient service training for medical professionals that received national recognition. When the medical center was acquired by a larger system, many of its programs were consolidated, but Nancy's innovations were adapted by the larger system, which viewed them as a fundraising advantage. For 20 years, Nancy flourished. Said a colleague, "Anything we did that was outward-facing, it was always, 'Let's bring in Nancy.' She was our go-to person for getting outside people involved." By her late 30s, Nancy was head of external affairs for the entire system, with patient services given a high priority and folded into her brief. But upon reaching this pinnacle, Nancy began to hit some bumps. Put simply, she was spread too thin, in part because her new portfolio was so broad, but also because she was still enmeshed in previous responsibilities. Patients and families she had worked with in the past continued to call on her for help. Nurses and doctors sometimes asked her to run interference when they encountered roadblocks. A nurse manager noted, "Nancy's always had this magic touch, a way of calming nervous and distraught people. Staff found it easier to bring her in than to try to deal with difficult situations themselves. They saw her as the linchpin for when things got rough." Community groups also preferred to deal with Nancy rather than the new people she had hired for the job. She found herself agreeing to a crowded schedule of public events. Nancy says, "I felt like I had 5 jobs, and it was running me into the ground. But I didn't really see a good way out. I knew I should focus on the job I had, but so many people had come to rely on me that I didn't feel right letting them down. I knew patient and family histories and problems. I knew the pain people were in, physical and mental. How could I say I was too busy to help? How could I tell them I'd become a big shot who didn't have time for their problems? They trusted me and saw me as a friend." As Nancy struggled to meet her many responsibilities, her staff began to question her approach. Some felt marginalized and viewed her as always swooping in to do their jobs. And despite her efforts, a number of high-profile patients who were accustomed to her being there for them sensed she was drawing away and grew resentful. Her attempts to please everyone were failing. She felt like nothing she could do was ever enough. Enter Ilsa. A board member who had known Nancy for over a decade recommended the system hire a coach who could help her figure things out. Ilsa had worked with dozens of women and quickly saw Nancy's problem, a need to be liked and viewed as caring and giving by virtually everyone she met. "I've seen this so often," says Ilsa. "Pleasing often works for women until they reach a certain level. Then suddenly it seriously does not. When you're in charge of a lot of people, you need to set expectations. If you don't, You're virtually training the people who work for you to rely on you. Ilse noted a number of factors at work in Nancy's dilemma, all of them common among chronic pleasers. First up was Nancy's pervasive sense of guilt. She felt self-conscious about going beyond her family's expectations and feared being seen as, quote, too big for her britches, unquote, a typical complaint in her family about anyone who was successful. As a result, Nancy was constantly trying to prove she didn't think she was better than anyone else. This made it almost impossible for her to say no. Nancy believed that if she left any of the people she had worked with behind, she would be seen as callous and only out for herself, says Ilse. That kind of judgment felt intolerable to her, so she kept trying to meet everyone's expectations. The problem was her expanded responsibilities didn't leave time or scope to do that. But rather than accept this and risk being seen as successful and therefore, as her family saw it, a snob, she continually let her boundaries be violated. Ilse also noted Nancy's excessive fear of gossip. She said, she couldn't stand the thought that people might be talking about her in a negative way. She knew the hospital was a gossip mill. Lots of workplaces are, especially those with rigid hierarchical structures, which certainly describes a hospital environment. People do get talked about, especially people in high positions who have moved quickly through the ranks. Nancy, however, imagined she could remain immune from sniping by being everyone's best friend. Many chronic pleasers share this illusion, says Ilse. Being liked was so important to Nancy that it was hard for her to accept she could not control what other people said about her. But as a senior administrator, she couldn't avoid stirring up some resentment. It comes with the territory, no matter how nice you try to be. You have to make peace with that if you are in a leadership position. Otherwise, you'll be at everyone's beck and call. Ilse helped Nancy by pointing out that she had been able to succeed only because other people had been willing to delegate responsibilities to her. If they hadn't, she'd still be on the reception desk. Framing it this way and showing how delegation could be a nurturing behavior helped Nancy recognize her constant swooping in as a disservice. As a senior leader in the system, she needed to give others the chance to flourish and grow, to feel their way and learn from their mistakes. Ilse had Nancy create a list of every task she did for a week. She then asked her to put a mark next to only those tasks that lay within her job description and use it as a prompt to set clearer boundaries for herself. It took discipline for Nancy to say no to people who had relied on her to do tasks that weren't checked off on her list. But as simple shifts in her behavior began to get better results, Nancy found it easier to push back. She also gained perspective on her need to please. Nancy had always viewed herself as a naturally helpful person, and she was. But now she also saw that her habit of taking on too much was rooted in her need to feel indispensable. As Ilse says, Nancy had to confront the fact that her over-involvement had the effect of making everything about her. This is usually shocking to pleasers because it doesn't fit with the I'm such a nice person narrative they carry around in their heads. The pleaser at home. As Nancy practiced greater detachment, she began to realize that her compulsion to please was also complicating her life at home. Just as she'd undermined herself by being overly responsive at work, so was she running herself ragged trying to make sure her kids felt they had the most wonderful mother in the world on every possible occasion. Here again, guilt was partly guiding her behavior. Because her job was demanding, she felt she needed to check every box when it came to her kids. Even when her son said, "It's fine, Mom, you don't really need to be there," She feared he might later resent her missing even a run-of-the-mill soccer practice. So her basic approach was to say yes to everything and then feel terrible if work intervened and she couldn't fulfill a promise. Many of the mothers in her kids' school did not work, says Nancy. They're like supermoms, putting on these amazing birthday parties with homemade treats and decorations they whipped up themselves. One of my neighbors spent a month making these gorgeous fantasy dragon outfits for her kids at Halloween. I felt like a failure when my daughter showed up in a store-bought ghost sheet. While Nancy had never resented her own mother's low-key approach to festivities, she feared her own kids would suffer if she failed to keep pace with neighborhood expectations. And she didn't want her family, or to be honest, the other mothers at school, to think she was a big shot with more important things to do. The sociologist Juliet Shore notes that contemporary culture has evolved what she calls the most labor-intensive style of mothering the world has ever seen, a level of involvement in children's lives that is without precedent. What's baffling and ironic is that this has occurred at precisely the same time that women have entered the workplace in significant numbers and begun to achieve high positions. In earlier generations, when far fewer women were employed, parents were rarely expected to show up at their kids' sports practices or ferry them to a heavy schedule of after-school events. Kids rode bikes around the neighborhood or played in the woods or basement. Birthday parties were mostly about ice cream and cake. Shore notes the deep conflict this shift sets up for women, whose guilt about working can make them reluctant to push back against expectations they realize are over the top. Social media only intensifies the pressure as documenting events becomes as important as the events themselves. As one skeptical mother notes, someone will post photos from their kid's party on Facebook. Say the party has a circus theme. The cake is in the shape of a circus wagon, and all the kids are given circus costumes to wear. Maybe it gets widely shared. All of a sudden, the other mothers feel like they need to come up with something adorable and original. The result? Everyone keeps ratcheting things up, and the working moms either feel like failures because they can't keep up, or end up spending insane amounts of money on a 6-year-old's party. At a certain point, the kids become almost secondary. It's all about the photos. Certainly the husbands couldn't care less. Sometimes I want to yell out to everyone, can we please just agree to stop? The only way off this accelerated treadmill is to be clear about your priorities and have the confidence to stand your ground and push back against expectations that have little to do with what really matters to you or, in many cases, your children. Otherwise, the demands, being endless, will consume you. Nancy says, once I got comfortable accepting that my primary purpose in life wasn't pleasing everyone else, I realized I needed to make time for what was important to me and my family, as opposed to what other people seemed to value. For example, I've always disliked crafts, so there's no point in spending time on that because it's what a great mom is supposed to do. Or because Instagram is full of cute pictures of moms and their daughters making wreaths. Nancy began having more honest conversations at home. She says, I had to get real and give my family a sense of my schedule and commitments. If I couldn't do something, everyone needed to know. Being honest, treating my family like partners, made a huge difference in how we communicate. We're much more relaxed together now. Coaches who work with women report that the disease to please is becoming more problematic because expectations are constantly ratcheting up. This is an unspoken elephant in the room at many of the women's conferences we attend, where programs on achieving balance have become a standard part of the repertoire. On one hand, women are urged to go for it and aspire to leadership at the highest level. On the other, They're warned about the consequences of missing virtually any activity involving their kids. The fact that balance is now more often described as work-life integration doesn't change the basic message, which is that women not only can have it all, but that they are fatally flawed if they do not. To retain any serenity in this ramped-up environment, you need to think long and carefully about your priorities. Not what would please others, not what would make everyone think you're the most wonderful person they've ever worked with or met, but what you, in your heart, want to be and achieve in your life. Given all the distractions and pressures you face, and the multiplicity of paths to feeling guilty, finding a way to push back against the disease to please is more essential than ever.
Chapter 13. Habit 9. Minimizing. A few years ago, Sally attended the meeting of a national women's organization that was holding its annual conference in New Orleans. After keynoting the big event, she was asked to sit in with the board to offer some thoughts on the group's new strategic plan. The meeting took place in a glass-walled conference room atop a downtown hotel. The board was large. More than 30 people were expected. Most held high-profile corporate, academic, or nonprofit positions. About a third of the board members were men. The room was cramped, so seating was crowded and haphazard. Flight delays caused by storms meant a fair number of people trickled in late. But as Sally tried to focus on the details of the plan being presented, she was primarily struck by the contrasting ways male and female board members responded to late arrivals. Virtually every woman acknowledged the newcomers by signaling that there was sufficient room for them to get comfortable. They pointed out empty seats, scooted their chairs aside to create more space, or found new seats for themselves at the room's periphery. They also made themselves physically smaller, pressing their legs together, holding their arms against their sides, shoving their purses under the table, even positioning their notepads more squarely in front of them. The men reacted differently. They nodded acknowledgement, or not, but made no attempt to take up less space. Those who were spread out or had an arm flung across an empty chair remained in position. Those whose belongings were scattered about did not move them. They stayed as they were, trusting the newcomers, all accomplished adults, to figure out their own seating accommodations. Fascinated by the dynamic, Sally began noticing body language in other situations and found it similar to what she'd seen in New Orleans. In general, women acknowledged others by minimizing the space they took up, even if it caused disruption. Men did not. Now, it's easy to interpret the women's gestures as welcoming, inclusive, generous, a measure of how attuned they are to other people and their needs. And in fact, all of this is true. And there's certainly nothing admirable about men sprawling all over the place, taking up multiple chairs, spreading their belongings about. Being clueless about the needs and physical comfort of others is not the behavior you want to adopt if you're seeking to move to the next level. But trying to shrink yourself isn't a great idea either. Small. If you're in the habit of acknowledging the existence of others by trying to make yourself smaller or taking a seat at the back of the room, you might want to consider how well this response serves you. As research conducted by social scientists and neuroscientists confirms, and many of us know from experience, when you draw in your arms and legs, tighten your body, hunker down or move aside, you undermine your ability to project authority and power. Not only do others read you as diminished, you begin to feel this way yourself. That's because your physical attempts to shrink send a message to your brain that you really shouldn't be occupying your space, either physically or metaphorically. You're not big enough, so you don't belong. Others are more deserving than you are. That's how your brain interprets your actions. It's hardly surprising that your body would send such a signal, since trying to get small is a classic submissive behavior. You've probably observed your dog lowering his eyes and flip down his tail when a more dominant dog approaches. Or you've watched your cat slick back her ears and flatten her fur as she slinks past the dog. The message your pets are sending is clear. I'm really tiny. I pose no threat. Take no notice. Just allow me to get out of your way. However unintended or well-intended, for example, the desire to welcome a newcomer, when you try to make yourself smaller, you send a subservient message to everyone in the room. This happens without you consciously meaning to do so. It happens simply because you're a mammal. Being a human mammal, of course, means that you also have the ability to use speech to minimize your presence. This is another habit that serves to diminish your power. Fortunately, there's been enough attention paid in recent years to the female practice of routinely apologizing that you may have become vigilant in avoiding it. When you hear, "I'm sorry," falling too easily from your lips, or when you use the phrase pointlessly to open up a conversation, "I'm sorry, I need to ask," you may have learned to catch yourself and self-correct. Yet other language minimizers persist, such as, in English, the constant use of the word "just," as in, "I just need a minute of your time. I just want to say something. I just have one observation." The word "only" can serve the same purpose. Other minimizers include "little," "tiny," "small," and "quick," used to suggest that you won't be taking up the other person's valuable time with something you, nevertheless, believe is important enough to mention. "I only have one tiny suggestion," or "if I could make a very minor point." Even more egregious, but unfortunately common, are verbal discounters and disclaimers. "Maybe this isn't important. You may have already thought of this. This may be beside the point." These verbal tics are usually employed at the start of a statement, where they end up doing the most harm. The millennial habit of routinely ending up every sentence on a rising note, which has the effect of making every statement sound like a question, conveys an uncertainty that both minimizes and discounts, while also seeming designed to invite contradiction. In addition to implicitly saying, "please don't mind me," minimizers and discounters convey uncertainty. They are yet another tool you can use to undermine your power. A study done at the Harvard Business School, "Who Gets Hurt and Why?", found that women are more likely than men to downplay their certainty when they speak, hedging assertions and proactively acknowledging that others may hold different points of view. It's not surprising that many women have adopted these habits, since certainty is often interpreted as arrogance, and women tend to fear getting tagged as arrogant. There's a good reason for this, of course, since women who are perceived as arrogant tend to be viewed in highly negative terms, whereas arrogance in men is often interpreted as confidence or boldness. Nevertheless, as the Harvard study confirms, conveying uncertainty is a good way to assure that you will not be hurt. People in positions of power tend to read uncertainty as a lack of commitment or preparedness. Given the no-win nature of the dilemma, either you're seen as arrogant or lacking in commitment, it's usually a good practice just to come out and say what you mean. Soft. Minimizing behaviors and figures of speech are particularly challenging for women raised in cultures that place a high value on female modesty and self-effacement. Aiko, an engineer I worked with in Japan, had been taught as a child that women should be tentative, hesitant, and very quiet, keeping their voices soft, and even walking with minimal sound. Speaking up and being direct were viewed as coarse, rude, and noisy, and evidence of a poor upbringing that reflected badly on a woman's entire family. When she stood her ground or tried to speak with authority, Aiko felt she was dishonoring those she loved. Humility, deference, and minimizing are in fact hallmarks of the distinctive women's language that well-brought-up women in Japan were, until recently, expected to use throughout their lives. It's a legacy that can get in the way as women in this culture seek to move to higher levels where they're expected to speak as equals with powerful men. Abandoning habits of deference can also be difficult for women from cultures where they have been taught to avoid making eye contact with men, to refrain from shaking hands, and to speak only when directly addressed. Such expectations and traditions make it difficult for women to project a sense of ease in mixed settings, which can hold them back from reaching their full potential. Many cultures also view indirectness as a polite behavior for women. Even cultures that pride themselves on being direct often subtly encourage women to diminish their impact by presenting an idea obliquely. This can take the form of prefacing an assertion with an unnecessary explanation. First, let me tell you how I came up with this idea. As you'll see in the following chapter, such preliminary hedging is often heard as offering too much information. Given that, it's usually most effective to be direct. We. As noted in Chapter 5, if you struggle to claim your achievements, you may habitually use we instead of I, even when describing an accomplishment that's primarily or entirely your own. You may frame it as we because you want to seem polite and inclusive. This may sometimes be appropriate, but often it merely serves to minimize what you contribute. In addition to underplaying your achievements, habitually speaking in the we voice can sow confusion about your role in a specific effort. Did you lead it? Were you essential to the outcome? Or was somebody else the hero? What exactly is we intended to convey? Psychologist James Pennebaker, writing in the Harvard Business Review, notes that a cross-cultural study of pronoun use reveals that women actually use the I word more than men. This is not surprising, since women tend to talk more, use more words when they talk, as we will hear in the following chapter, and speak more freely about their intimate feelings. In fact, Pennebaker attributes women's use of I to their attunement with their inner state and comfort with personal conversation, in contrast to men, who are more likely to speak about objects and events. But this is true for communication in general, as opposed to the workplace. In professional situations, women who are otherwise comfortable with self-disclosure routinely resort to we when speaking about their own success, as Amy did, the nonprofit leader in Chapter 5. It's not difficult to guess why this would be so, since speaking about your own accomplishments is an inherently assertive behavior, and women are often penalized for seeming assertive. As Sheryl Sandberg and Adam Grant, writing in the New York Times, have shown, women who speak assertively are far more likely than men to be viewed negatively at work, a finding your own experience may confirm. Yet, as Sandberg and Grant also found, women who fail to assert themselves also tend to be viewed in negative terms. The real problem, they conclude, seems to be speaking while female. One way to finesse this double bind when it comes to talking about your achievements is to give your team or coworkers credit for joint success while also articulating how you supported or strengthened the team's efforts. This has the effect of turning a lose-lose scenario into a win for you and a win for your colleagues. Splitting the difference can make everyone happy, and especially if you're speaking with a confident male leader who has no problem claiming credit. Constantly referring to we may suggest to him that you had nothing to do with a successful effort. So given the choice between sounding self-centered and underplaying your hard-earned achievements, you're probably better off forthrightly using I. Hold your space. Whenever you use words or actions that minimize your presence or contributions, you show uncertainty about your right to take up space, to hold it, to occupy it, to inhabit it fully. Others tend to read this hesitancy as a failure to really show up and the inability to project a strong and engaged presence. For decades, Sally has been asked what women can do to convey a more powerful leadership presence. Questions tend to focus on the cosmetics, the right clothes, a firm handshake, a confident tone of voice, whether a woman should carry a purse, even whether plastic surgery can be helpful. Yet decades of exposure to a wide variety of extraordinary leaders has shown both of us that the key component of leadership presence is the opposite of cosmetic. It lies in the capacity to be fully present. Present for a task, for a conversation, for the moment, for an opportunity. Present for your larger purpose in the world. As it turns out, there's a reason the words presence and present are related. Today's high-intensity, technology-saturated, 24/7 work environment makes it difficult for anyone to be present, but women face particular challenges. Multiple responsibilities can scatter your attention. Home as well as work requires professional skills, which can make every day feel like a marathon. You just need to get through. And women's capacity for broad-spectrum notice, the radar that will be described in Chapter 16, is a great potential strength that, nevertheless, comes with a downside. It can make it tough to focus. Yet, even as the capacity to be present grows more challenging, the benefits of doing so increase. This becomes truer as you move to a higher level. For example, being present is the most powerful way to connect across cultures, which makes it valuable for leaders in a diverse global environment. People from different cultures can immediately read whether you are fully available to them because your body language always lets them know. Think about it. You can't calm a small child if you're checking your cell phone. You can't train a dog or a horse if you're worrying about what your boss said this morning. And if a 3-year-old and a member of a different species can tell whether you're engaged, a fellow adult from a different cultural background surely can. In addition, empathy, which is increasingly recognized as an essential leadership skill, depends upon your ability to be present for another person. Research demonstrates that you feel empathy when you're attending to another person so closely that your neural pathways start mirroring each other. Empathetic behavior, therefore, depends on your capacity to show up fully. When you're distracted, you can neither feel nor project empathy. New research cited by Susan David in her recent book, Emotional Agility, demonstrates another benefit of presence for women. She notes that, although women often struggle to be heard, they in fact receive as much attention as men when speaking in public, if and only if they are perceived as being fully present. Being present also has the effect of making women seem more credible and authoritative. This powerful finding adds to the evidence that the ability to rest in the moment and hold your space is vital for women seeking to project leadership presence. The capacity to be present requires freeing your attention so you can show up where you are. And because of the special challenges, as well as the specific benefits described above, the ability to do so can be especially valuable for women. So what can you do to free your attention so you can inhabit where you are? You might start by pushing back against compulsive multitasking, a practice women often seem to take perverse pride in. Swearing it off entirely is impractical, but it's important to realize that while multitasking feels efficient, it always comes with a cost. For the fact is that doing two things at once makes it impossible to be present for either because your attention, by definition, is fragmented. And fragmented attention is a highly effective minimizer. Multitasking is also the quickest route to mental exhaustion, the true source of which is not being busy, but the strain put on your brain when you're doing two things at once. By contrast, research into meditation and other mindfulness practices shows that the most powerful way to re-energize and refresh yourself is by focusing your attention on one thing instead of permitting it to bounce all over. Multitasking also diminishes you by giving the impression that you're overly responsive to random events. If you see someone constantly checking her phone in a meeting, you don't think, wow, she must be important, and you certainly don't think, what a strong presence she exudes. Instead, you're likely to conclude that she isn't in control of her own time or schedule and is therefore incapable of showing up for what's actually going on. By demonstrating over-responsiveness, she minimizes both her importance and her presence. The good news is that permitting your attention to be fragmented is not a character flaw. It's just a habit. Like minimizing, hedging, softening, shrinking, and ceding space, these behaviors don't necessarily betray deep-seated insecurities. They're just ways of responding you've grown accustomed to over the years. Reflexes you may have already outgrown. They may have helped you at some point, but they will undermine you as you reach higher by making it impossible for you to manifest or enjoy the serenity and power.
Chapter 14. Habit 10, Too Much. As a woman, you may have found yourself having to tamp down your emotional register when you're in professional situations, especially around high-performing men. You may do this in an effort to match your mood to the prevailing workplace and leadership culture, or because you've gotten feedback that you come on too strong or are too intense. Women frequently hear these comments, but knowing how to address them can be confusing. On one hand, there are definite costs to being tagged as being a bit too much, particularly as you move higher. You may be seen as unprofessional or unreliable when you are neither of these things. You may get called out for not being a good fit. On the other hand, having to constantly repress your natural responses can make you feel awkward, inauthentic, and stiff, draining away the zest and enthusiasm you need to perform at the highest levels. Excessive self-monitoring can depress your energy and inhibit your ability to be your best self. It can kill spontaneity and undermine your ability to have an impact. Routinely repressing your feelings can also diminish your capacity to inspire trust. Coworkers may interpret your reluctance to respond from the heart as evidence you're hiding something. They may wonder what's up with you, why you can't just be real. Most likely, they're blissfully unaware of how criticism you've received in the past makes you hesitate to be direct. The too much, not enough divide is another of those damned if you do, damned if you don't double binds that frequently plague women and become more problematic as you move to a higher level. The pain of dealing with this conundrum and the difficulty of locating that sweet spot between letting it all hang out and keeping yourself tightly under wraps adds an extra burden that can make you feel as if you don't belong. If you work in a mostly male environment, the negative effects of expressing your feelings can be compounded by the difficulty men often have responding to women. Some men resent women's ability to be vulnerable. They've had to repress displays of hurt and fear all their lives, so why should women be allowed to show their feelings? It seems unfair, a form of female privilege. Other men feel manipulated by any expression of strong female emotion because they believe they have to do something to assuage or contain it. If they don't know what to do, they may feel resentful. The upshot is that the whole business of emotional expression can be a landmine for women. Women's emotional range is, of course, not limited to expressing vulnerability. You may also get feedback that you are too enthusiastic because you greet new ideas and suggestions with immediate and wholehearted endorsement. In many cases, a simple desire to support and encourage others lies at the root of this response. But in a buttoned-up culture, it gets misinterpreted. We've seen women falter on both sides of the too much, not enough divide. But we've also watched women resolve the conflict to their advantage. Recognizing that success in any endeavor requires discipline, they find a way to bring their immediate reactions to full awareness and then respond with passion tempered by experience and intention. As this way of responding becomes a habit, they take on an emotional gravitas that draws integrity from the intensity of the effort. The usual culprits in the too much scenario for women are too much emotion, too many words, and too much disclosure. And while the path to addressing these critiques is similar, each calls for different specifics. Too much emotion. In his work with male clients, Marshall finds that anger is the emotion most likely to get in their way. As he notes in the original What Got You Here, successful men who lash out in anger often justify doing so as a useful management tool. They imagine it's an effective way to motivate sluggish employees and send a strong message about the importance of whatever is at stake. Yet the routine use of anger actually has the opposite effect, causing people to shut down, tune out, and lose motivation. Of course, both women and men react in anger at work. But in our experience, women are more likely to display strong emotion in the form of anxiety, resentment, frustration, or fear. And the expression of these painful sensations is the primary reason many women get tagged as being volatile or too emotional. Men, of course, also experience these emotions, but they've usually grown accustomed to stuffing them or to channeling fear and anxiety into aggression. The message that anger is the only acceptable way for men to display emotion is conveyed from early childhood and finds reinforcement in team sports, where anger may be viewed as a sign of competitive drive. Parents and teachers, as well as coaches, tend to give girls more latitude in displaying hurt, fear, and frustration, or otherwise letting their vulnerability show. So it's not surprising that women tend to be more comfortable acting on these emotions. But given that the leadership model in most organizations has been set in the male image, these emotions find little acceptance, even though they're usually less destructive than anger. Let's be clear. What you feel is not the problem. There's no such thing as a good or bad emotion. Your emotions have enormous value. They provide useful information about the situation you're in, vital clues you would be unwise to ignore. Emotions are the wellspring of your intuition and the prime source of your energy and passion. They get you out of bed in the morning and keep you engaged when the going gets rough. So it's vitally important to recognize what you are feeling at any moment, to identify and accept the emotions your circumstances are stirring up. However, speaking while in the grip of strong emotion is usually a bad practice. Your perceptions about who's at fault may be distorted. You may overstate your case. You may come across as touchy or out of control. And you most certainly will be unable to calibrate your response in a way that lands with maximum impact. To recap, feeling and identifying your emotion gives you power. Reacting to what you feel squanders it. Rosa, a native of Colombia, is an executive in a construction firm with projects all over the Amazon basin. She's also the client of one of our coaching colleagues. It's rare to find a woman in her position, in her part of the world and her sector, but Rosa attributes a good part of her success to her ability to harness her strong emotions and make them work in her favor. Learning to do this was not easy. Early in her career, Rosa was often stereotyped as a volcanic Latina. It didn't help that she looked like Sofia Vergara. But being called too emotional once too often made Rosa determined to find a way to temper and use her emotion instead of letting it get in her way. She describes a typical situation. I was in a meeting recently in Sao Paulo. We just met with some investment partners and things had not gone well, she says. Our executive team was venting about what they'd heard and doubting the good faith of our partners. But the primary emotion I kept hearing from them was desperation, as in, no matter what, we've got to make this thing work. As the only woman in the room, Rosa knew she couldn't afford to get worked up. So she did what she always tries to do. She says, I waited patiently, listened to what everyone was saying, and tried to tap into what I was feeling. I realized my dominant emotion was actually dread, and that while part of me wanted to go through with the deal, which we'd been working on for over a year, I knew in my heart it would be a mistake. When she was clear about what she was feeling and sensed a lull in the conversation, Rosa spoke, keeping her voice firm and low. Here's her account of what she said. I feel obligated to be very honest with you as my colleagues. I'm uncomfortable with the direction this project is taking, and since many of you feel this way as well. You all know I have a good record of being right when I listen to my gut, and I am listening to it now. This deal still looks great on paper, so I understand its appeal. But I fear we haven't thought through the implications of partnering with this firm. I believe